Welcome back to the Wisdom for Warriors podcast. On this segment of Let's Remember in September, I'm joined by Jake Veit.
All right. Welcome back, everybody, to the Wisdom for Warriors podcast. Started a series this month. It's going to be called a Let's Remember in September. So found it fitting with everything going on in Afghanistan to kind of make this topic a little more, just to bring more awareness to it. We have a lot of OEF veterans that have different experiences, and I'm just going to bring as many as I can on this month to kind of talk about their experience, especially after last month with everything going on over there in the last few years and whatnot. So also being in September, also to kind of remember 9/11, I know growing up after 9/11, I was the most patriotic I've ever seen this country, and I don't know what happened since then. Couldn't go two doors without seeing an American flag, but now it's un-American to be American. Anyways, so I'm here with Jake Veit. Jake grew up in Davenport, Iowa. He went to his first police academy at 21. He was a University of Missouri officer for 2 years before switching to a city police officer. He spent just under a year there in the city before enlisting, just like a lot of us had that active itch to get into the fight there. So he joined active duty in 2009, where he went to the 101st. We're going to get into that a little bit. We were kind of in each other's stomping or backyards the whole time we were there. He was a CAV scout with the U.S. Army. Deployed in 2010. After he got out, you got your associates in welding and metal fabrication, moved back to Iowa to run your family farm. I'm curious about that because my wife wants a farm now that we got chickens. then you moved back to Kansas City in 2020. You said you were driving some commercial trucks there for a little while. Very similar. I almost did that myself after I got out. And then you went to the Veteran Affairs Police Officer, which is where we met back in 2023. Yeah. So about sum it up.
Yeah, Jake? That pretty much nails it. That's definitely the short end of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. how old are you?
I am 41. I'm old.
Okay. Yeah. So you got a couple more years on me, but, we have a lot of, similarities in different things. Obviously we're at the 101st together, unbeknownst to us. And then our careers is what ultimately let us cross paths. So Jake is a Veterans Affairs police officer in Kansas City, correct?
Leavenworth, actually. We're like
Leavenworth, okay.
45 minutes apart, the hospitals are.
Okay. Yeah, so he's up there. He came through the academy. I was his instructor for defensive tactics, our ground defense. Might have been on the range. I don't remember. It all becomes a blur. But he then came back to be an instructor on the mats to do the ground defense and the defensive tactics, everything. So that's where our relationship kind of expanded. I think one of our first conversations started off around hockey.
Yeah, I had a Warriors hockey shirt on.
Yeah, that's what it was. So, for any veterans out there who might want to be in hockey, if you look up the state you live in and then Warriors after it, there's a possibility that there's a hockey club out there that is a nonprofit and they can get you hooked up with some hockey. I played for the Michigan Warriors for all of about 7 seconds. but it's a great organization, and it's in quite a few states. So if that's something you might want to do, get around a bunch of other veterans, learn how to play hockey, have some fun. That's something to look into.
Absolutely.
But to move past that, the other thing that got our that kind of started our relationship was one way or another, you know, just in talking, and you know, we were both in the Army, and then found out we were both at Fort Campbell. So you when did you get to Fort Campbell?
I got to Fort Campbell in June, May or June timeframe of 2009. Yeah.
Okay, so we literally got there the same time.
Yeah, because
I wonder if we could have improvised.
Oh, very possibly, because I did OSIT at Knox in January, and then did 16 weeks there, and then once I got done there, I went to Benning and did jump school, and injured my way out of that school. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Landed wrong and twisted my ankle real good. So, nice. Yeah. You know what?
Not service connected.
No, yeah. No, what was great is, yeah, just get your command staff's approval and they'll send you right back and you can finish your jumps. I don't know of any unit that isn't airborne that's willing to send you to airborne school.
Yeah. Okay, so you got there, I think you said June of 2009. I'm pretty sure a lot of it's a blur at this point, but I'm pretty sure that's when I got there. I remember, I know one way I can figure it out. When did Michael Jackson die?
When did what? I was
in processing when that happened. Michael Jackson died.
I have no idea. Did you have Sergeant Major Camacho do your in processing speech and make this huge deal about not drinking and driving?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, and then we all come to find out that he had like 4 DUIs.
He was a spokesperson. Yeah, right. Yeah, so Michael Jackson died June 25th, 2009. I remember seeing that in the Chaw Hall while in processing at
camp. Oh.
So yeah, we pretty much got there like within a couple weeks.
That would have to be, yeah.
So small world. So I went to be under the glorious command of underneath 4th Brigade, which was Currahee. So if you've ever seen Band of Brothers, no big deal.
Yeah, I'm saying that's you guys' big claim to fame right there.
Yeah, you were a rocket scientist.
Yeah, the bastard children of the 101st. Yeah.
Yeah, so for anybody non 101st, all right, so anybody that's listening that was 101st, if you weren't a rock assigned, you understand how I feel. If you were, you understand how Jake feels. So I'm going to give you my impression, and I'm pretty sure I've said this to your face.
Yeah.
Rock assigns are essentially like obnoxious kindergartners.
With guns.
Yeah, with guns, right? So they have what's called a Tory, and if correct me if I'm wrong, but the Tory was the symbol for what
it's
the Japanese saw.
Yeah,
right?
No. Okay, so like the Tory is a structure that you see a lot in Japan, and it's like a divine gate, they call it. It's got like a spiritual or religious reference. I'm not exactly sure the tie into their culture, but that's what it is, as far as I know.
Okay.
And then, Rakusan is the Japanese word for umbrella man.
Because, that's what.
Yeah.
It is.
Though when we jumped in Japan after World War II, or at the end of World War II, they didn't have a word for paratrooper.
Right. So Rakusans, the brigade, Tori was their symbol, and these fools put it everywhere.
We sure did.
And they would walk around just yelling Rakusans.
Yeah,
literally. I'd be downtown Nashville and hear Rakusan, like, oh my gosh.
Yep. And then somebody somewhere answered to it.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah.
So they're more like drunken kindergartners. Yeah. Obnoxious kindergartners. So I know we deployed right around the same time. When did you head out?
January of 2010.
Okay, so you left in January 2010. Yeah. We were the last brigade to leave. Traffic was amazing.
I bet. It was fantastic.
So we left in August.
Okay. 10.
So we were a few months behind you. But we got to Fob Sharana, and I don't know where the brigade went from there as far as the Rakusans, but man, again, Tories everywhere. I'm talking like they had a 30-foot one that they had built. which was pretty impressive. It was actually like, it was like nice. It wasn't like just, you know, kind of weird looking or whatever. They had them, they drew them on porta potties. They painted rocks. Like they were everywhere.
There was a,
I'm sure,
porta john in, at Manas Air Force Base in Kyrgyzstan that had a Tory in it.
Yeah.
And every time the same guy came through, he would initial it and date it. And there was like three initials and dates underneath it.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
I thought that was hilarious.
That is funny. So, yeah, they put these I remember seeing them. Like, literally, I'd be walking to Chow and there'd be rocks. And I'd accidentally kick a rock and it'd flip over and there'd be a Tory.
I've heard stories that there you will find a Tory on every Army installation, but
oh, yeah, I bet
I'm sure there's one somewhere.
There, you guys are probably on an FBI watch list at this point because we're throwing around gang signs and symbols and stuff. So that was I got there in August. So where did you go initially once you got to
Afghanistan? Let's see, we flew Shannon was the first place we got stuck. Shannon, Ireland. I was supposed to be a quick layover and leave, and then we found out Manas was snowed in. So we stayed a lovely evening in Shannon, Ireland at a lovely hotel that we couldn't leave.
So that was in January
you went through there? That was January.
So just I flew into Ireland on my way home for R&R in December, and then on my way home from Afghanistan in August of the following year. And I swear the temperature was the same. It was still
didn't
green.
Change. It was beautiful. Beautiful country. Yeah. I wish they'd have let us go explore, but it was my goal was for me and my wife to get back there and visit sometime.
That'd be cool. Go ahead.
And then we flew from Shannon, Ireland to Manas Air Force Base in Kyrgyzstan.
So let me pause you there real quick. Kyrgyzstan, that Air Force Base was nice. It was one of the most beautiful places I've ever
been. When I went there,
I remember
it was covered in snow and ice, and it was like, it was like everything was former Soviet bloc, and it literally looked like a 1980s action movie setting.
Well, the mountains were beautiful. Let me rephrase that, because it was. You know, it was August when we went through there, but they were still snow capped, and you know, you could see just seeing the sunrises and sunsets there. It was pretty awesome.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't get to see that. We went
because
our internal clocks were so screwed up, we were sleeping all day and we were awake at night.
Because I think it was like a 12-hour difference from back
probably.
Home.
Probably, who knows? I know the people were very nice. I remember that. Like the locals that worked on base were super nice people.
So here's another thing for non, military, or people that have been to Afghanistan through Manas, the people there look Mongolian.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. And they speak different forms of, Pashto, Arabic, different things like that, but they look Mongolian. So it's really interesting. You know, you get people that have never left. Some people have never left their state, let alone the country. So it's pretty cool when you can get out somewhere else like that. And
it was very much meet people east that meets west there.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I mean, like the people you could see like more western features, and like you were saying, you could definitely see more eastern features on a lot of them too. So yeah.
Yep.
And then from from Manas, we flew into Kabul or Bagram Airfield, whichever. And then spent like a night there, I think. And then the next day we flew from Bagram to Clark. And then from Clark, we flew to Clark in C-130s, which that's. Man, that's like flying in a car.
Some of the best sleep I ever got. What are you talking about?
I got great sleep on C-130s on the way back. On the way out, I didn't sleep so hard.
Yeah, oh yeah.
that's like flying in a cargo truck, though. And then from Clark, we took CH-47s out to Cop Wilderness, which is where we took over. So.
Okay. So before we go past that, because I'm ignorant, what exactly is a Cap Scout?
Okay. So in a conventional war setting, obviously with coin operations and asymmetric warfare, it's everybody's job's a little different, but we are the eyes and the ears of the commander on the battlefield. And how that works is like, we're like, if you like, in a, let's say in a conventional war, like let's, you know, God forbid World War III kicks off, the cavalry scouts would be like the leading element of the 101st Airborne Division. And like, you know, they would be the lead screening element. They would be the guys who, you know, do route reconnaissance. Basically, hey, can we get big trucks down this road? Can tanks come down this road? These are the guys who, okay, well, that looks like it's possibly an enemy position. And they map all this stuff out and they pass all the information back to hire. And that's in a light infantry division, like in a heavy infantry or heavy division, like First Armor or something like that. You know, they'll be the guys out front with the Bradleys, and then they'll have dismounts kick out and like check choke points and stuff like that that would really hem up the tanks. But yeah, it's really, you know, it's just mostly eyes and ears of the commander on the battlefield is the best way I can describe that job. At least in, like I said, in a conventional war setting.
Right. Okay. So that makes sense. You know, now, you know, hearing that little, that description and then thinking of the name, that makes sense. Obviously originally I can only assume it was all horseback.
Yeah. Way back when it was all horseback. And I mean, a lot of original Cav Scouts way back when were Native Americans. For whatever reason, that was a lot of them. A lot of them were like civilians too.
Oh, because they knew how to ride horses well.
Oh yeah, but I mean that's probably part of it. And there's a fun piece of trivia for you. The horse was the only vehicle that the army ever bought specifically for cavalry. Like the Bradley wasn't bought for cavalry scouts or anything like that. The horse was the last thing that the army bought originally for cavalry scouts.
Interesting. Okay, so you're out at was it a cop or was it a fob at Wilderness? Okay, so a cop. So I know on my last episode I talked a little bit about it. Cops are generally significantly smaller than a fob. They can be super tiny. Some of y'all might have bigger yards.
Ours was actually. So initially we were told it was a fob, and then we were told it was a cop, and we weren't sure. We just went with one or the other. Like, we had Portageons. Right. The highest ranking person we had was our own CO. Two of our scout platoons were on there. The third one was shipped out to like a patrol base. We had a platoon of MPs, and then a couple weeks or about a month after we got there, we got two 105s brought in. The thing was, is they were like, well, we got no place else for these, so they're getting two 105s.
Those are
the artillery pieces, yeah, the 105 millimeter howitzers. Yeah.
Those are big artillery rounds again for people that might not be familiar. They make a little bit of a noise.
Yeah, they were nice to have. Yeah, we got two guns, and then we got the artillery guys to go with them. So it worked out pretty well for us.
Oh, there you go. Okay, so what was y'all's mission over there?
We basically got used kind of like baby infantry unit. It was a lot of like, this is your area of operations, you know, handle it. You had the... We called them Shura Sundays. It was like you had the key leader engagement meetings on Sundays and, you know, route clearance occasionally, but I think that was mostly handled by like, It's usually it was usually a National Guard or Reserve unit that handled route clearance stuff. But like, yeah. You know, so we'd go out to a lot of the villages, like especially we tried to get out to the more remote ones that we knew hadn't seen a lot of ISAF forces. You know, just make our presence known, you know, try to win the hearts and minds, that kind of stuff. I mean, that was the vast majority of it. I mean, as time went on, it turned into, hey, we've got intelligence that you might have a bomb maker in your AO. Can you guys go check this village? And then it was, you know, hey, we're going to go take this hilltop for, you know, I call it a movement to contact. And it basically just means you're going to go pick a fight. So, right. So yeah.
Yeah, that was a lot of what we did. We were training the Afghan police.
Oh, were you? Okay. We worked with them a little bit.
But we kind of assessed them and then handed them off to the other platoon to train. Okay. So we were doing a lot of, you know, movement to contact, just trying to go find something to get into.
Right on.
So you were at that same, you were at a COP or FOB Wilderness the whole time you were there?
Yep. We went up to like, I mean, that's where we lived. I mean, we drove out to Clark once for a vehicle handover, and then we drove up to Gardez once for like a vehicle retrofit. But besides that, we pretty much stayed in REO the whole deployment.
Okay.
You know,
did you guys have like contractors out there with you, like cooks and stuff like that?
On our base, no. The only contractors we had were some of like the construction guys, and then we actually like I say next door, but like you have to go up and over a mountain. Or a really big hill, however you want to look at it. And
right,
there was a construction company there that they had been contracted to like basically turn the Coast Gardez Highway into like a solid surface road. And I think when we were there, they were like 3 years behind contract and, you know, tens of millions of dollars. Still good?
Oh, of course. Yep, I got you. So you said you were in Paktia. Hello? You got me? Jake from State Farm. Hello. Hello. Hello.
I think it says you're muted.
Well, that's weird. How about now?
Yeah, there you are.
Oh, that's weird. All right. That's an easy edit out.
Okay.
All right. So go ahead.
So there was this construction company. Their whole job was to basically pave the KG highway. And I still to this day don't know if they ever finished it. But they had a bunch of mercenaries for security guys. And, you know, like dudes from South Africa and Russia and, I mean, they were super nice people, but, you know, they're probably war criminals back home. You know?
Yeah, it was fun. We had, I think they were, I forget what the Polish SF guys are called, but we had a little team of them on our little FOB.
Is it Grom?
And I'm pretty sure, like, most of them were on steroids. They were freaking huge.
Probably.
And they're very serious about volleyball. We had a volleyball, a little volleyball court, and like it was like the one part on the whole FOB where it wasn't like moon dust really. It was like super compact.
Okay.
But we had a little volleyball tournament, and we beat the Polish guys, and they were not happy. I was like, yeah, we might wake up tied to our bed or something tonight. I don't know. And it's funny because, like, you know, on the first episode I did with my buddy who was on my tour, you know, out there with me, you know, I remember different things. But now just talking to you, just like how the different memories of the tour just pop up, like the random things and not. So you did a year there as well, then, I'm assuming?
Yeah, we headed back January 2011. We flew back home.
Yeah.
Yep. And then we found out, like, the unit that replaced us were the guys that went to the nine-month tours. Yeah. And then, it was wild. I mean, that, like, being deployed is probably one of the best, worst times of my life, if that makes sense.
Sure.
You know, you don't worry about bills and the latest and greatest cell phones and, you know, what Puff Diddy's doing to who or what's latest with the Kardashians. You know, none of that stuff matters. And that was the one thing I would, honest to God, like, that was the one thing I loved about being deployed. You don't have to deal with any,
that makes sense.
Any of the mundane garbage that we have to deal with now, you know? So.
Yeah. And that kind of ties back to kind of what I was kind of getting at with, like, just meeting new people, like in Kyrgyzstan, and just, like, same thing in Afghanistan. Like, people complain about things here in the U.S. I promise you, we have it good, and you can attest to that too. Like, we have it good.
But there's times where I'm like, you know, maybe they've got it better than we do. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
they don't.
It's simple.
It's a simple life. It's simple. Yeah, you know, they don't. Like I said, I mean, you're not worried about having to pay taxes on your house over there because it's been in your family for four generations, and it's made out of dirt and wood. But
no, that is true. It's a different way to look at it.
I don't know.
Maybe when we were there, yes, not so much right now.
Though. Yeah, that's probably true. Yeah, I would say, yeah. Now that we've left, I'm sure people are paying taxes of some sort or another.
Oh, it's not great over there.
No,
for
that
citizen,
that whole ordeal. You know, the fact that they just left all that stuff blows my mind. Like, who thought it was a good idea to leave drones? Like, I mean, like, even in our trucks that we took out on patrol, we carried a couple of thermite grenades to incinerate what was the computer system?
The Blue Force Tracker.
Yeah, we carried one to set on top of the BFT, and we had one to set on top of the radio stack.
Yeah, so the Blue Force Tracker is like our GPS system when you're deployed, and it'll show where other units are and different things on it.
Yeah, it's like
that's one of those things. Like, you know, even though I've been thinking a lot about this, and I've been hearing about all the stuff over there, and I've been seeing some of the stuff, you know, on the news or what they have of ours. That's one of those things that I never really thought about. They literally have all of our technology. Yep. I know some of it's encrypted to where they can't just use it freely.
But I mean, you look at how much stuff they reverse engineered, you know.
Right.
So, I mean, my thing is, you know, Afghanis may not be able to unencrypt it, but the Chinese or the Russians might.
Yeah, that's true.
No.
That's true. What's one event over there that sticks out the most to you?
when
you were there?
Well, we like, obviously in combat's usually one that stands out most of the time. I remember our first contact, like we had gone, so like in Afghanistan, like they've been at war long enough with, you know, nations that are usually better equipped than they are, that once it gets dark, they usually stop, like with us, that once it got dark, they stopped fighting with us, you know, because they knew we could see them, but they can't see us, you know. And then once it got, you know, if it gets too cold outside, I mean, they're not going to fight. So it got started getting into like summertime and getting warm out. And, you know, we'd gone on several missions and not gotten into any fights or anything like that. And then we had this reporter come with us, and he was from NPR, and I can't remember the guy's name. Saved my life. But he was an American who lived out of Beirut, and he was you know, one of these war correspondent guys. And yeah, he and he did like, yeah, he did pieces for NPR. So, and we're like, as soon as we found out this guy was coming with us, the jokes, you know, the dark jokes start, like, oh great, we're all gonna die and it's gonna be this guy's fault because he showed up, you know.
Yeah, right.
So we went out, we hit like two different villages just to kind of show this guy around, and they wanted to see if we could find this place that we would get, like they would mortar wilderness, like where we live, they would mortar it or rockets or whatever. And they were trying to see if we could find where they were shooting from. So, you know, so we went out and wandered around and looked for all that stuff. And I mean, the whole day, nothing happens. And the lieutenant's finally like, all right, that's it. We're going home. It, you know, we got to, you know, it's going to be a couple hours before dark and we're not going to get stuck out here. So we started heading back. And that's, I won't say everybody relaxed, but, you know, it's like the drive home. Everybody's like, all right, you know, things are kind of on autopilot. Right. And I can't remember the name of the village. I want to say Surikel, but I don't think that's right. Like you had to drive across this river, and like if you went too far to the right, you like you fell off into the river kind of thing, you know, like
right,
you know, if you, you know, so like I was up in the gunner's turret, so I had to help the driver kind of stay on the road, or he, you know, drive off into the river and we'd all drown and die or something. So right. We get across the river and you have to go up this hill to the right. And as you're going along this road, like the ground to the right-hand side drops off and the ground to the left-hand side goes up into a mountain or a hillside.
Yeah.
And we're driving along and I swear to God, I start hearing popcorn. I'm like, what is that? And so I kind of just start, I was in the lead truck. So I start kind of traversing the gun to the right. And then it sounds like somebody's throwing rocks at the truck.
Yep.
And then I heard another pop again, and then it all clicked. And I was like, oh, we're being shot at. And so, and then the fight was on, as the meme goes. Yeah. I mean, like I, you know, my driver Brownie goes, man, all we heard was con. And then you got drowned out by the 50 cal. We couldn't hear anything else. And I just started laying it down.
That's such a glorious sound.
Oh, it is. Yeah, we had a four truck concept, and so our lead truck and our follow truck both had 50 cals, and then our two middle trucks had the Mark 19s. And yeah, man, we could really lay it down. It was great. It was great. And then so we just started smashing this hill that we thought it was coming from. And our forward observers that were with us, they got out of the trucks and they started calling in 105s. And then, you know, somebody said we got Apaches coming too. And it was, I think everybody just got really excited because it was our first combat, you know. They did try to shoot the Apaches down. Like, I will say this, we had to stop the 105s when the Apaches came on station. And sure enough, we saw this explosion behind one of the Apaches, and our forward observers goes, hey, are you setting off flares? And they're like, no. Well, come to find out, one of the bad guys had shot an RPG at one of these Apaches, and he I mean, he probably missed by about 50 feet. So, yeah. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, that's not far off of a miss.
No, no.
So, yeah. No, we almost had ourselves a Black Hawk down there for sure.
Yeah. What kind of vehicles are you all rolling?
We had a menagerie. Mostly the Max Pro. We had Max Pros, and then we had one RG-33 that kept breaking down. And then we were the first unit to get the MATVs.
Yeah, those are
though beasts. They were like 300 horsepower, fully independent suspension, straight piped cat diesels. They were loud as shit and fast as hell. They were great.
So loud.
They were great. Yeah. Yeah, man. No, that was our first combat, and then like our other big one is we were in it for like later on, we were in it for like 72 hours straight. We moved to this. It was the hilltop that the insurgents always wanted to fight over, you know. So that was like that was why we moved out there. We just set up camp over there overnight because we knew they'd come fight us.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, like it. We went out there. We set up. I'm gonna try to remember this in order. We set up, and then somebody pointed out that there was a spotter, like that we knew they were watching us, kind of deal. So right. We had moved a couple of our guys out away from like our little patrol base that we'd set up to set up an observation post. We'd sent three guys out there, and then they had set up a couple of claymores. And we went through the whole night, no issues. Well, they get up in the morning, and apparently somebody had snuck up on them close enough to cut one of the lines to the claymores.
Ooh.
Yeah. That's some ninja skills right there.
Yeah.
So we started bringing those guys back. And then, oh, my God. We had a couple of NCOs that got real, I don't know, man. Like, they got, like, real cowboy action hero kind of mentality for a minute. And so, so our platoon sergeant, one of our E5 team leaders, and our senior scout, our E6, like all went out into the brush to see if they could find this guy and smoke him. And they went far enough away that if they really got into it, they were going to have problems getting help. So, and sure enough, they did. They said they kind of went over this hilltop and look down into the valley, and that's when basically all hell break loose. And I remember it clearly, like they called over the radio after all of us heard this one explosion, and there was this pause. And my lieutenant goes, and my call sign was Two Golf, and he goes, "Hey, Two Golf, was that our dismounts?" And I said, "Stand by." And as soon as I said that, the guys that were the dismount party said, "Hey, Two Golf, was that you guys?" And I was like, "Nope." And as soon as I said that, that's when all the gunfire started. And they're like, "Oh my God, we're in contact." Yeah. And then
they were in contact.
The dismounts were in contact, and they were literally running for their lives to get back to us. I mean, we started dropping mortars on our old observation post because we think the bad guys moved into it. I was shooting so much, we actually had to do a legit under fire barrel change for the 50 cal because the barrel swelled up so much. We had a cartridge get stuck.
Oh,
yeah, we were in it, man. I mean, like legitimately in it. I mean, and it was like, and it was coming from everywhere. Like, we were on a hilltop, and then there was hilltops on three sides of us. So it wasn't like, it was not a good tactical position, but anytime you're in a mountain fight,
a lot of places in Afghanistan weren't very good tactical.
Man, like there was no good place to fight in Afghanistan. Like there just wasn't. Like the whole fight and maneuver concept in a mountain range doesn't work.
And I feel like a lot of some of the worst some of the worst positioning for some of those cops and those out.
Oh, you know, yeah.
We're literally in the middle of a mountain, like surrounded by mountains.
We were literally, our cop was set up along a highway next to a river. We had mountains on both sides. Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
Thanks, LT.
That wasn't even our LT. That was like 3 units ago that set that up.
Yeah, some good idea.
Yeah, Ferry. Some good idea, Ferry. It's exactly what it was. But yeah, no, like we ended up having to have ammo brought out to us by another platoon and get reinforced by them. So those guys, white platoon, third platoon, who's the second? I don't know. They brought us ammo in the dark, and they had to drive up, basically drive along a ridgeline of a mountain in the dark, and to do it. And it was like, those guys had courage. I will use that term to keep it family friendly. legit. Like they literally drove. Like those guys could have had that road in mind, or IEDs or whatever, and just wiped them out. But those guys did it in the dark, and they brought us ammo.
Well, not only that, but like you were talking about how earlier where you had to guide your driver from the turret. I talked about it with my buddy on the last episode. Like I remember this one mission. It was at night. Somebody messed up my mine roller controller, so I couldn't use the mine roller lights, and it was just a mess. I mean, it was one of those tiny roads where, you know, foot to the right, you're falling into a 30-foot hole. So I had to kick them out a bunch, and like our vehicles were just too big. And any like night missions, that's where a lot of my anxiety I think comes from.
Yeah,
just driving along. Like I remember there'd be some times where I remember the sun came up. We were on this, I don't even remember where, but a sun came up, and I looked to my I could finally see stuff outside. And there's like a 100-foot rock face like going up. And then, you know, a mile down the road, it's the opposite. You know, it's just, it's 100-foot going down. Like,
oh, yeah. A lot of those roads, if we'd come off them, we'd have been dead.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
But,
no, it was.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was nuts.
That's crazy.
I mean, and like, you know, like you really. I guess you really get the measure of a person in that kind of environment. Cause like guys don't think about themselves, you know? I mean, it's just the amount of, I don't know. It's like, I don't know how to describe it. I guess I'm running out of good vocabulary.
It's definitely like the most selfless thing one can do.
Yeah,
you know,
and look out for each other 100%, you know.
And it's not even that, like in those moments most warriors are gonna do something to save their buddy to their left and right,
100%,
you know, helping himself. It's one of those things that a lot of people don't understand, that camaraderie, that, you know, we might die, but I'm going to try and make sure you live over me type of
thing. Yep. You got to look out. I mean, that, like in the end, that's all you got is each other. You know, whether in a combat environment, at work, at home, that's like that. In the end, that's all you got.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we go ahead. Sorry.
No, you're good, man. Just kind of keep moving along. Did you guys have any casualties?
Yeah. Out of the original, scout platoons with in the light infantry division, at least with the 101st when I was there, scout platoons about 20 people. For reference, like most infantry platoons are usually between 40 and 50. So we went over there with 20 guys, and that included our medic and our two forward observers. And of the original guys who went over together, four of us didn't get purple hearted or die.
Wait, say that again.
So of the original, 20 dudes that went over, we had we had two guys get transferred to different platoons. And then, so the original platoon, we had like two guys get transferred out. And then everybody else, we had three guys get killed. And then everybody else got Purple Hearts.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yep. That was, we had a 2010 was the, if I remember right, 2010 was the highest amount of casualties for ISAF forces, at least for American forces in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it was definitely up there.
So
we had, I think we had like four or five get sent home.
Yep.
But
yeah, we had, our first one was Sergeant. Unless you don't want to hear about it, I'm willing to.
Yeah. If you're willing to talk about it, this is the
environment,
for helping people understand.
So Sergeant Eric Klusicek, we called him Clue because if you just tried to read his name off, it was confusing as hell. he was my team leader, and he died in a really tragic accident. So we were working with so many different models of trucks that like some of them had air brakes and some of them still had hydraulic brakes. And one of them started having issues, like the brakes kept going out. So we're like, all right, that's it. We're going to tow it back. We don't need somebody driving off into oblivion.
Right.
Well, so what happened was, is he was going to hook up the tow bar and for some reason or another, they were moving the vehicle that didn't have brakes instead of moving the vehicle that was going to do the towing with brakes. And so they went to, like, he was holding the tow bar up so that way they could, you know, it was pinned to the, it was already pinned to the vehicle that didn't have brakes, right? So he was holding the tow bar up to line it up with the pinel hitch on the towing vehicle.
Right.
Well, the brakes went out and he didn't get out of the way. And so the vehicle that was going to get towed smashed in the back end of the vehicle that was supposed to do the towing, and he was caught in the middle. And then we took turns breathing for him for a while. And that's when we found out that the 9-line cards that we'd all been trained on back in Campbell were not what ISAF and NATO were using anymore. Because they had a 13-line card, apparently, that was supposed to get issued to all of us that we never got. And because one of those extra lines was whether or not they needed an intubator to breathe for somebody, and we didn't get one. And the worst part was, is the radios didn't work. So we had to take one truck with three people and drive like 5K away up onto a hillside to get signal.
Ugh.
And it was like it was an ordeal. I mean, so when I went into the military, I was 24. I turned 25 in basic and I turned 26 in Afghanistan. And so I was one of the old men. Right. And I had been a cop before. So I already knew what was happening. I just seen it happened before that he was not getting the treatment he needed quickly enough.
Yeah.
So I was pretty prepared to because we finally the birds came in, they finally airlifted him out. You know, it was quiet, basically nobody wanted to talk about anything, which makes sense. I mean, everybody was pretty upset. You know, we got back to Wilderness and basically first sergeant and CO and the chaplain are all waiting on the in the LZ that we used for our parking lot. Right. And as soon as you see those people waiting for you after dark, you know something bad's happening. And we all got out of the trucks and first sergeant's like, just leave your shit. Somebody else will get it. Just leave it. I'm like, oh yeah, that's not good. So they take us up to the DFAC, which is open because usually after a certain time out where we were at, the DFAC closed. And if you didn't make chow time, you were doing the brown bag.
Yep.
So chow hall was open. Food was ready. We got in there and they said, basically Clue was dead 15 minutes after the birds left. And so yeah, that was rough. It was rough for, it was really rough for the kid who was driving the truck that hit him.
I'll bet.
And I mean, I don't want to take up your whole show here, but you know, kid's last name was Dukes, and Dukes never recovered. Like he never recovered from it. Like he had a, he developed a drug problem once we got back, and they chaptered him out, and then it was, it was, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, he ended up overdosing and dying. Me and one of the other guys went to his funeral up in Chicago. So yeah, and then the other two guys that we lost in combat was Adam Novak and Chad Coleman. And Novak was a replacement, and Novak was something else, man. He showed up, and he kind of had the attitude that, like, no matter what happened, everything was fine, you know? Yeah. It's like even when you were smoking the dog shit out of him for dumb stuff, he was just like, ah, everything's fine. You know, and he took everything well. I mean, he integrated very well because of that. Coleman was with the platoon before I got there. And he was young is the best way I can describe it. He was very young. I don't want to say mentally, like he was deficient, but like he didn't have a maturity level that he needed.
As many of us during that time.
You're right.
I had just turned 21 when I went over there, and you know, we had guys that were under 21 there as well.
For
you know,
sure.
some people, a lot of guys were going straight out of basic. Yep. So if you're joining at 18, you might be in Afghanistan before you're 19.
Oh yeah, no, these guys were both under drinking age. I mean,
yeah.
I think like we had out of all the Joes that we had, I think only two or three of us were over drinking age. All the rest of them were just babies, you know? Wow. Yeah. But Coleman struggled. We had our first serious fight, and after Clue died, Coleman had a little bit of a break. He kind of, I want to go home, I can't do this kind of thing. And I get it. He's young. He's not going to be prepared for that. So they put him on gate guard kind of permanently, because that way he could at least still contribute but not be a real liability. You know what I mean? I mean, that's not somebody you can take into the field with you. So.
Right.
So I'm going to back up a little bit here. So this is a little weird. So Clue and I had a discussion before Clue passed. I had just recently married my now ex-wife, and then he had a wife and a daughter, and him and I got talking because, you know, everybody kind of had their assigned R&R dates. And he goes, hey, do you mind if we switch? Because I have missed basically every anniversary for the last 3 years, and I would like to go home for that. I said, sure, no problem. So we swapped. And so Clue dies, right? And I still have his R&R date. So I take his R&R date and I come home.
So for just real quick, for those that might not know, so R&R is a rest and recovery. What was it, like 2 weeks?
Yeah, 10 days or something 2 weeks. Like that we got? I mean, by the time you got home, it was like 10 days. But yeah, it's supposed to be 2 weeks.
So you could either go home or go travel the world. I had a couple buddies that went to like Guam or different.
Yeah.
Most people go home to their family.
We had a guy that went to Japan for 2 weeks. He said that was just amazing. But yeah, we went to Kuwait, and we flew out of Kuwait wherever you were going after that. So,
I forgot about Kuwait until you
just Oh, man. I cannot, because I remember getting off the plane there at 2:30 in the morning and it being 96 degrees and 80% humidity. It was miserable. It was miserable.
The AC would be rocking in those tents, but not until after the sun went down did you actually feel like it was AC.
Yeah, the AC would be running nonstop, but boy, it was still hot. Oh, man, miserable. And then God help you if you had to go to the bathroom during the daytime. Yep. Yeah, the bathrooms were just a pressure cooker too. So I took my leave and I came home, which means Nick Brown, he had to step up to be the gunner. And Novak had to step in to be the driver. And anyway, so they, after I left, they hit one IED. And, there's a retention pin on that 50 cal mount that's supposed to keep the gun in there. Well, it broke loose. And the butterfly trigger came back and punched Brownie in the face on either side of his nose, basically.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Well, it was bad enough that they sent him to Germany and said, it's a head trauma. You're going home. You're done. Yeah. Wow. So shortly after that, then they had a, so our, it was our third, yeah. Blue is our second, no, blue is third platoon. Yeah, white was second. Okay. So blue platoon got it in their head that they were going to go on this mission and they needed to go through RAO to go, because they wanted to see if there was like a back road. Into this one village in their area. So they decided they needed more men and another truck to do it. Well, instead of coming to us and being like, hey, can we like borrow a truck and some of your guys? They immediately just ran right to the captain and said, well, we're going to need this stuff. So yeah, that's the way the Army works, I guess, you know, orders are orders, but like, you know, kind of respect the guys that you're going to ask to go out on your mission with you, you know?
Right.
So anyway, so they do that. And so a bunch of our guys volunteer to take this one truck and go. And it was our senior scout, Paul Matrenga, and then it was our senior Ford observer, Chester Thompson, and then Adam Novak and Chad Coleman, and then Stanley Mehta. I was gunning. And our guys had said, hey, let us lead the way. We know where we're going. It's our area of operation. We know what's up, you know. Well, they didn't want to do that because their senior scout needed more experience and he needed to lead the way and this and that. So it happened, right? So they were driving out and sure enough, like there's this very narrow checkpoint or choke point on this ridgeback and they didn't catch the IED. And so it, okay, so just real quick for your listeners here, usually people that are actively watching the roads to set off an IED will not strike the first vehicle. They'll hit the second or third one because that's usually where the people in charge are. Okay, so their truck ran over it and cleared, and then they set the IED off on our first platoon truck. And it, those MATVs are not as resistant to explosives as they told us they were, because basically the truck just kind of accordioned up and to the right. And so the exterior doors on the passenger side both popped open. Chester and Paul got ejected. Chester landed on a rock and broke a couple vertebrae. Paul landed and then the truck came down on him. And, I believe this is like 100% true. So the truck landed on his head. And when the wheel compressed his helmet, it ejected his head, but it peeled his scalp at the same time. And I'm sorry, if I'm getting too graphic, please let me know. All right. So it peeled his scalp off or open, and then the chin strap took part of his ear. And then Stanley was wearing his gunner's harness like he's supposed to. So he got up, and then the gunner's harness started reeling him back in. Is it like paddle ball? You know, like the ball on the string with a paddle?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, he was going up and then getting retracted back in as the truck was still coming up. And so when he slammed back into the truck, it broke both his legs, and it cracked his pelvis. And then because of the way the truck folded, Adam and Chad had no place to go besides the ceiling. And they both collided with the ceiling, and it killed them. And then it turned into a big firefight, and then they got, they got everybody out and medevaced, and that was basically my fire team right there. My whole section was gone, and
you were on R&R during this.
I got a phone call from Stanley's wife, and she told me some of it. She didn't know everything, obviously. OPSEC, they didn't tell her everything. So, I was pushing people out of the way to get onto airplanes and stuff to get back as fast as I could. I got to Kabul, and I got picked up by the brigade liaison. And he's like, hey, we got to stop by the hospital first. And most time when you come back from a hospital, before I left, what I knew was Stanley was hurt, but he was okay. Brownie was hurt, but he was okay. I didn't know about anybody else. And so I got to Kabul. They said, hey, we got to go by the hospital first. And this is how I knew something was wrong, because I was carrying all your bags and shit back from R&R. And this E6 grabs all my bags to carry them for me to put them in the truck. And I was like, something's wrong here. Yeah. Something's really wrong here. So I was only an E4 at the time. And he goes, hey, we got to stop by the hospital first. And I was like, okay, why? Because we'd all heard that when you come back from R&R, you got to take a pee test. I was like, okay, well, that's probably what it is. Well, this guy looks at me and says, hey, Sergeant Thompson's getting his Purple Heart. And some of your guys are there. And I was like, why is my Sergeant Thompson getting a Purple Heart? And he goes, I'm going to let them tell you what's going on. So I get there, and one of the other guys who had gone on leave at the exact same time, the other team leader, actually, I was made team leader after Clue died, and the other team leader and I were spent on R&R at the same time. So he catches me in the lobby of the hospital, and he's like, hey, man, just so you know, he goes, Adam and Novak and Coleman are gone. I'm like gone, gone, or like sent home gone? And he's like, no, they're dead. And I was like, okay, who's here? And he goes, well, Medi flew out to Germany this morning. And he goes, and Chester's probably leaving tonight. And they're going to give him his Purple Heart. And so we went in and talked to him a little bit, and he was incredibly, he was on a lot of painkillers. So he was even more, Thompson was an incredibly loud human being to begin with. So he was even less filtered.
Yeah, I was about to say less of a filter.
Yeah, way less of a filter, because he turned like, the division, or like there was the squadron commander was going to come Purple Heart him, and oh man, it was an ordeal. But anyway, so I walk in, I see Chester, and and Chester was an incredibly we'll just say an incredibly horny individual. Like, and somebody got, like, he had porno mags stacked on his end table, and it was so. Anyways, he looks at me when I walk in, and he's like, you know, man, they're dead, dude. And I said, I know, brother, I know. And he's like, I want you to know. He goes, Coleman turned it around. He goes, and like, he's like, the last 72 hours of his life, man, he turned it around. Said, what do you mean? He like, he didn't have to go. Like, he begged to go on these last couple of missions. And because he, like, our platoon was short, but he, you know, so he begged to go. And they said, all right, here's your second chance. And, like, you know, when the IED hit the truck and Brownie got hurt, like, they could have sent Coleman out. And he said, nope, I'm going to stay until, you know, I'll be one of the last guys to leave. It's fine. And, you know, he was calm, cool, and collected, and was like a grade A soldier right up there until the end. And he goes, you know, he goes, I want everybody to know that he turned out okay. And then the squadron commander and squadron sergeant major came in, and he was like, those M-ATVs are effing garbage, man. You know, just letting them have it. Just letting them have it. And
good for him.
And the best, like, and the funniest quote about Thompson is Chester Thompson, right? The funniest thing I ever heard him say was, you don't know how hard it is being a white kid growing up in El Paso. Because he sounded Hispanic. Like, when he talked like he was Hispanic. And it was hilarious.
Oh, that's funny.
But, yeah, after that, man, like, me and the other team leader's name was Calabrese. And, like, literally, like, after they told us Thompson was leaving, like, him and I literally, like, we just got on aircraft. We knew we're going where we needed to go. Like, we weren't on a manifest. We just said we're going. And you're going to have to call the MPs to get us off this helicopter. Or off this aircraft, one or the other. And they, and one aircraft was a civilian contractor. And the guy's like, well, we might. And they're like, go for it. And like, and the guy, and the pilot's like, why do you have to be on my helicopter right now? And we explained it. And he's like, oh, screw that. Push the mail back off. They're staying, you know? And they flew us back out there, man. I'll tell you what, one of the most surreal experiences was opening the door to that, our little hooch, or the shed that we all lived in.
Yeah.
And it was empty. The lights were out, and it was completely empty. Like, the lights were never out. Even at night when people went to bed, the lights stayed on, you know?
Right.
There was no talking. There was no laughing. There was no joking. There was no screaming. There was no nothing. It was just silent. And that was... like, that's when it really all sank in. Like, I started crying my eyes out, and the platoon sergeant walked in because he heard I was back, and he started, like, oh, man. We both just started crying, you know. It was a very it was an awful experience, but, I mean, you know. And then it was, I got very protective of that building. Like, people were like, oh, you can move into this other building with the rest of the platoon and this and that. And I was like, nope, this is my room. This is where I live. This is where I'm staying. You know, and, like, people wanted to help me box up everybody's stuff. And, like, I almost got into fist fights over that. I was like, no, I will box their stuff up. I will send their stuff home. I will do it.
Yeah.
You know, it was. Yeah. So.
Well, man, I appreciate you sharing that. You know, and I'm sure it's not easy to talk about, but, you know, it's good that you talk about it.
It is.
And it's good.
It's important.
Yeah, absolutely. Because a lot of, you know, one of the bad things about military service is, especially for combat arms, is, you know, suck it up, just do what you got to do to drive on, you know. Drink water, change your socks, drive on.
Rub dirt in it.
Don't talk about our feelings. And we don't get the help in physically and mentally we need until sometimes when it's too late, right? So I'm glad you're able to talk about it, man. And you know, thank you for talking about it.
For sure.
That's rough.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to do it, you know?
Yeah, man, for sure. So just to switch gears and kind of, you know, wrap this all up. I was going to ask, I was thinking about asking the guests on this, September to Remember. Do you remember where you were on 9/11?
Absolutely. I had, I was going to a junior college at the time, and I had just gotten home, and because it was a short day. So it was like just after, I want to say it was like right around lunchtime. And I remember I turned the TV on, and I was in the kitchen, I was making food, and I looked up and I watched second plane strike.
Yeah. Did you think in that moment that 9, 10 years later, you'd be over there fighting that war still? In general, be over there?
I'll be honest with you, like, initially, I was one of those people, I won't say I was against the war. I was against the way the war was being fought. I did not, like, a two-front war never ends well, you know?
Yeah.
So when I found out we opened a second front in Iraq, I was like, well, that's dumb. but no, honest to God, I did not think we would still be fighting over there by the time I enlisted.
So I had, when I was a child, young boy, if you will, I wanted to be a cop and I wanted to be a soldier. So
me too, brother.
I can imagine that I thought that I wanted to join, but I was only in the seventh grade when it happened. So it's kind of crazy for me to think that, you know, it was 9, 10 years later that I was over there. Because I would have gotten there. So it would have been the 9th anniversary shortly after we got there. You know, it's crazy. And then to think, well, we're coming up on the 23rd anniversary.
Yeah.
And again, man, just thinking about the patriotism after that time, you know, I've thought about this probably even like 10 years ago, like how the country has changed, you know, even before all the nonsense in the last, you know, few years or whatnot. But just to think of how we could go from that to be such a united country to where we are now, it sucks, you know?
That it does.
But really, to really tie it all home, though, like, you know, like I talked about at the beginning, the whole idea was to kind of just bring remembrance to Afghanistan. You know, we were there because of what happened on 9/11. It's, you know, one of the things that bothers me the most about what's going on over there now is people just have no idea. Like, they're, our biggest enemies are some of the enemies we've had for decades are all in Afghanistan right now.
Yep.
Not only that, but we are funding them 40 to 80, I think it's like 43 to 87 million dollars per week.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, you know, it's the Taliban, they're doing this or that. No, they're not, friend. You know who else is there? Al Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
Who's Al Qaeda? They're the ones that attacked us on 9/11.
Yep.
You know where some of that money's going? To Osama bin Laden's son,
mm-hmm.
who, by the way, has vowed to get revenge. We are literally funding our enemies. And it's crazy, right? I'm trying not to be political about this, but the open borders, we have there's no way to estimate how many terrorists have come across that border. just from different like CIA people I've listened to podcasts and stuff on there. It's definitely in the thousands. And that's scary. You know, it's just a matter of time before something else happens. So with that said, part of this segment, wrapping up on these podcasts, at least, I want to kind of just talk and see if there's anything you're doing, or might consider doing just to help prepare yourself and your family.
Yeah. I mean, we've got chickens now. We're also planting a garden for the spring.
Okay.
And I'm getting my overweight body into the gym finally.
I like it.
Getting consistent anyways. I've been hit and miss for a while just because of life. But I've also like got a good gym membership a great gym that I go to, but I also got some stuff for the house. That way, if like I can't get to the gym that day, I can do something at home.
It's awesome.
Yeah. So that's the big one. And then, like I said, you know, we got chickens for eggs, and then the wife and I are kind of planting a garden for the front yard in the spring. And, you know, so that's kind of that. And I mean, you know, obviously guns and ammo.
Yeah. Right. So that's awesome, man. I want to, just caution you, chickens are a gateway drug.
100%.
Because I know my wife's like, oh, I want a pig now, and I want a goat, and I want this, and I'm like, we are one phone call away from getting arrested as it is with all the animals we have.
So I raised pigs on my farm.
Oh, okay.
And I will they're a lot of work. I mean, if you're just
she wants one to like run around the house.
Oh, okay. Well, I can't blame her for that. I do too. Yeah. But I'm just saying, if you're gonna raise one to eat.
No.
Oh, okay. It's one of those. Okay.
No. I'm, that's actually, we had bought a pig earlier in the year, and once it's gone, I think I'm giving up pork actually.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, we can talk about that offsite.
Sure, yeah, for
just cause the diets and stuff change.
Okay.
But, something else, man, like that's awesome. And I know, so as men, as husbands, as fathers, we've got to, you know, protect our home. And that's not just, you know, guns and ammo, right?
Well, for sure.
I've been trying to, personally, I've been trying to make my wife a little more situationally aware, because when she's with me, she's like, I don't got to worry about anything. You're there. I'm like, that's cool and all, but I need to feel comfortable that, knowing that you're checking things too when we're not together. So that's something I would challenge not only you, but like just the listeners in general to I mean, I'm sure you could find YouTube videos about just being situationally aware, because that's a big thing right there. Like if you look like a target because your nose is in your phone all the time and you're not paying attention, you're more likely to be, you know, a victim. But if you're aware and your head's on a swivel, you're checking things, you know, that could help prevent something happening to you. So just little things like that. You know, I'm you're a firearms instructor too, correct?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have the plan to start teaching my wife stuff like that more. I've made her throw on tourniquets and like timer, you know, just little stuff like that. Not only like in a God forbid, like a terrorist situation, but also just in general, like, right? Like if we have tourniquets all over the place now, because what if you're in a car accident, or what if you roll up on a car accident?
Yeah. Right? I mean, that's the big one. It's like, you know,
save your life or, yeah. So just little things like that, I think would help us prepare our families
for sure. And I'm also like, I'm an avid reader, but I also think having like certain books in the house is always a good idea, like basic first aid or basic gardening books.
Yeah.
That kind of just little things to get you going, you know.
Absolutely. That's cool, man. I'm glad to hear that. I really do appreciate you jumping on here with me, man.
Of course, thanks for the invite.
I really appreciate you sharing your testimony on, you know, what you experienced over there. I think it's important for the listeners to kind of hear, you know, and understand why we're so upset, you know, why the veteran community is so upset about
that parade,
how the withdrawal happened. Yeah.
God, that parade.
Yeah. Yeah. If you don't know, the Taliban had a parade, marking the 3-year withdrawal, and they were using our vehicles in the parade. So just on that quick note, it's estimated that we left anywhere from, let me find this, $7 to $80 billion in equipment. We'll never know the actual money or amount, but I'm sure it's probably somewhere at least in the middle. I know some of the vehicles we brought over there were million-dollar vehicles. Like, nothing we brought over there was cheap, and we left it there, friends. We left it there, and what are they doing? They're either using it or they're selling it to other terrorists. They have all of the same exact equipment that our soldiers, Marines, airmen, etc., train with, buy stockpiles of it all over the country. We just left it there. And now if we need those things, guess where that money comes from? Taxpayers. Like, what are we talking about? It's craziness. Anyways, I digress. So again, Jake, man, I really do appreciate you jumping on here.
Of course. Thank you.
Man, when you're in town here in a couple weeks, make sure you pop in and say, hey.
Oh, absolutely. I'll stick my head in.
Yeah. So I'm going to go ahead and pray this episode out, and then we'll wrap it up. You got anything else you want to add?
No, just thanks again for having me on, man. I really appreciate it. It was good chatting with you.
Yeah, brother, it was good. All right. Dear Heavenly Father, I just want to thank you for this little platform that you've provided me to help share the word, to help share the knowledge of you, to help shed light on some of the things going on in the world. I just want to thank Jake and just pray for a hedge of protection around him and his family, and just, you know, thank him again for sharing his story and just help in sharing to help heal his heart. I just want to pray for the families of his battle buddies that he told the stories that were we lost in war, and just all the casualties. Just I pray for any of them that are still suffering, that you can just come down and help heal them, help get through whatever they may still be going through. Because, you know, it's we were never designed to fight alone, and especially being military members, we're not solo members. And I just pray that they know that there is help out there, and that they can be healed. Lord, I pray for anybody listening to this podcast. I pray that they can, if they do enjoy it or they get something out of it, that they just share it so that we can help spread the message. Lord, just pray for everybody to have a good week from here on out. And pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, brother. Well, I appreciate you.
Thank you very much, sir.
And we will we'll see you soon. All right,
take it easy.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to leave 5 stars and follow us for future episodes.